Case number calendar 07-656 and 657, State of Ohio versus Thomas Benny. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The trial court committed an error under Criminal Rule 11C2C when it failed to give an oral advisement regarding the defendant's right to require the state to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt at a trial. The question presented here is what standard of appellate review applies to that error. It appears that there are five potential standards of review in play under this court's case law. First, under the Ballard strict compliance standard, the appellate court reviews the plea colloquy as a whole to determine whether the trial court in some reasonably intelligible way covered the information contained in the advisement. If the court did so, then there's no error and the plea is affirmed. If it did not do so, then the plea is vacated absent and without any showing of any prejudice. Second, under a substantial compliance standard recognized in cases like Stewart and Nero, the court reviews the record as a whole to determine whether or not the defendant has demonstrated any prejudice from the trial court's error in failing to give the advisement. Third, under an offshoot of the substantial compliance standard recognized in a recent case called Sarkozy, the appellate court looks at the entire record to determine whether there was some minimal compliance with the rule. In not giving the advisement. If there was no compliance at all, then the plea is vacated, the substantial compliance analysis ends, and there's no assessment of prejudice. Fourth, under Criminal Rule 52A, the appellate court would review the record as a whole to determine whether or not the trial court's failure to give the advisement was prejudicial or harmless. And fifth, under Criminal Rule 52B, in the absence of an objection in the trial court, the appellate court would review the record as a whole to determine whether the defendant has demonstrated plain error. As between the strict compliance, substantial compliance, and no compliance at all standards, it's my submission that the court has already decided this question and determined that a substantial compliance standard applies. In the Stone case, which is a pre-Criminal Rule 11 case, this court reviewed the plea in that case under constitutional standards and upheld the plea, even though the trial court had not covered the right to require proof beyond a reasonable doubt during the plea colloquy. I believe Stone shows that strict compliance is not the constitutional standard in addressing this type of issue. In State versus Sturm, this court explicitly recognized that the Stewart's substantial compliance standard applies to the failure to give an oral beyond reasonable doubt advisement.
Explicitly recognized in a footnote. Wasn't Sturm the footnote case?
It wasn't a footnote.
How much value should we? It brings up my abhorrence of footnotes when to state the law. And as here's a good example. Court puts in a footnote, and what does it mean? If it means that that's the law, why is it not in the text of the opinion?
Well, it was a per curiam opinion, so I assume every part of the decision is meant to be a statement of the law of the case. But that issue was before the court. They chose to address it in a footnote. I don't know that there's any distinction as far as precedent goes regarding whether it's something's in a footnote or whether something's in the text. And the Sturm footnote is not the only thing we have going for us. There's also the Ballard case issued just the same day. And in Ballard, the court listed all of the oral advisements that would require strict compliance under the test set forth in Ballard. And they listed four of the constitutional rights listed in C2C, but they excluded the beyond reasonable doubt advisement. Between Ballard, which is syllabus language of the court, and the footnote in Sturm, I think it's clear coming out of those two cases that a substantial compliance standard applies to a trial court's failure to give the oral advisement of the beyond reasonable doubt right. And under the substantial compliance standard, it's our submission that the state should win this case. and that the plea should be upheld. The defendant approved the entry of guilty plea, which specifically recognized and indicated that the defendant was aware that he was waiving his right to require proof beyond a reasonable doubt at a trial. The defendant also acknowledged in response to the court during the plea colloquy that his attorney had gone over his constitutional rights with him. And I think there are other indicators, such as the fact that it was a favorable plea agreement, reducing his potential punishment from 21 years to 8 years. I think all of these things point towards the conclusion that the defendant would have accepted this plea even if the court had given the oral advisement. He actually did receive a written advisement, and he did acknowledge that his attorney had discussed his rights with him. And so it's our submission that the substantial compliance standard is met under Stewart and Nero. Above and beyond the issue of strict compliance versus substantial compliance versus no compliance at all, it's our contention and this that there should be no reversal for plea advisement error in the absence of prejudice or in the absence of plain error. As this court recently stated in State versus Wamsley, Criminal Rule 52 gives appellate courts narrow power to correct errors that occurred during the trial court proceedings. Criminal Rule 52A provides that any error or defect that does not affect substantial rights shall be disregarded. And Criminal Rule 52B provides that errors or defects not raised in the trial court shall only be reversed for plain error. And even then, reversal for plain error is discretionary on the part of the appellate court. Both of these rules are broad enough to apply to plea advisement error. And this court, in fact, has cited Criminal Rule 52 in plea cases, including the Billups case, Stewart, and Nero. And in the United States versus Vaughn, the United States Supreme Court recognized that harmless error analysis and plain error analysis applies to plea advisement error. Any standard of review that results in automatic reversal for the failure to give an oral advisement, in my view, conflicts with Criminal Rule 52. And in fact, this court's structural error case law recognizes that this court should not adopt or adhere to any requirement of automatic reversal. Only structural error justifies a finding of per se prejudice warranting reversal. And to constitute structural error, the error must be constitutional in nature. And there's no constitutional error in this case. As the United States Supreme Court language in various cases has shown, any right to an advisement under Boykin, and I submit there's no right to an oral advisement under Boykin, but even if there were, it's limited to the three constitutional rights mentioned in that case.
Counsel, could that be argued that those constitutional rights that are mentioned are really just to illustrate as opposed to be a definitive limited list?
Well, it has been argued that, and that's what the Court of Appeals argued, the majority argued. My response is twofold. Number one, that contention was contained in a dissent in the United States Supreme Court from a denial of cert. And in the Stone case, this court recognized that language from the Johnson case, from the Johnson dissent, and basically said, we don't think that's the law. It appears that the majority thought that the plea was good enough without the beyond reasonable doubt advisement or without a complete panoply of all the constitutional rights. I think that's, the Johnson dissent argued that, and it was not adopted either by the U.S. Supreme Court or by this court. As you see down through the years, the U.S. Supreme Court cases, when they talk about Boykin and talk about the constitutional rights that require some sort of on-the-record showing of knowledge, the U.S. Supreme Court has limited its language to the three rights mentioned in Boykin. It has not extended Boykin any further than the right against compelled self-incrimination, the right to jury trial, and the right to confront witnesses.
Why is it not as important for a person who is pleading guilty to know that, or waiving trial, to know what the state's burden is? The Court of Appeals seem to indicate they just sort of say this is the same kind of issue, or the defendant has the same sort of interest in this knowledge as he or she may have in the Boykin knowledge. Why is that not a rational, reasonable approach to this?
Well, It's a rational, reasonable approach in the sense that this court's Criminal Rule 11 requires it, and has made the right to require an advisement on the reasonable doubt standard, made that part of the Rule 11 colloquy. But it's my contention that the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have not made that a constitutional requirement. Now, the Court of Appeals said there's no rational basis to distinguish between these. And I think there is a rational basis in the sense that a plea colloquy, if the trial court had to advise of all the constitutional trial rights that potentially are implicated by a guilty plea, the pleas would go on forever. And I could go over a list. I've thought of 12 trial rights that Criminal Rule 11 does not cover. And if this court
we confine it to this one. We've made the determination in the rule that this is important for a judge to instruct the person who's about to plead guilty, that this is one of the pieces of information that person ought to have. And I guess it's not an awful burden on the trial judge to have to do this, is it? I guess most trial judges probably do inform them.
Well, it's not a burden, Your Honor, and I, as far as the rule including it, yes, it's in the rule and it should be given. But I think the rule cannot elevate something that's not a constitutional right. There's no constitutional right to a beyond reasonable doubt advisement. The rule can't elevate it into a constitutional advisement.
We can elevate it into a rule of plain error, can't we? Doesn't have to be a constitutional right for us to say this is plain error.
Well,
does it?
It's plain error in the sense that the court clearly violated the rule, but it does not, in this case, meet the standards for reversal based on plain error.
You'd say there had to be some showing of prejudice.
Correct.
Counsel, we note that Rule 11 talks about what a trial judge has to say to the defendant before taking a plea. But as I understand it, in this particular case, the trial judge did accept an entry of guilty that included the statements that are in 11C2. Is that correct?
Correct.
So, I mean, in a sense, we are not saying the trial court totally ignored the obligation to talk about the right to have the state prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That information was given in an entry that then became part of the record, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, one of my arguments, too, as to why this is not constitutional error is the fact that Boykin itself does not require an oral interrogation of the defendant. There is case law, including in the Billups case out of this court, recognizes that there is case law upholding pleas when there has been a written document showing that the defendant was aware of his constitutional rights and was willing to waive them.
There's some language in Winship, however, that U.S. Supreme Court has said that it's part of the due process constitutional right. What's your response to that language? And I think your opposing counsel has raised that issue also in the brief.
Well, I think the issue of whether substantial compliance versus strict compliance applies, there's some debate in the appellate cases about whether the advisement is constitutionally required or whether the advisement addresses a constitutional right. I obviously have to concede that the right to proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a trial is a constitutional right under federal due process. But in my view, if you're choosing between strict compliance versus substantial compliance, in my view, the issue should be whether the advisement is constitutionally required, not whether the advisement addresses a constitutional right. And in this court's cases, there's language in several of this court cases, it seems to indicate that this court is looking at whether the advisement is required. And I think of the Martin case, which involved whether or not there was a written waiver, whether the written waiver requirement for the right to counsel required strict compliance or substantial compliance. This court said substantial compliance, it's not a constitutional requirement that it be in written form.
Mr. Taylor, were you present when the plea was taken in this case?
Because
I wondered, depending on the procedure, many courts, before they will accept a written plea form signed by the defendant, will say something to the effect that, have you looked at this form? Do you understand what it says? Have you consulted with your attorney? And if all of the language in C2C was already in the written form, This seems to me, even in a sense, a strict compliance that the court would have informed the defendant only through a written material rather than saying it orally.
Well, the court did not go into all that much detail. The court did ask the defendant whether he had approved the entry of guilty plea, and the defendant said yes. And then the court a little bit later asked, and you have reviewed your constitutional rights with your attorney, is that correct? And the defendant answered yes to that as well.
There was nothing in the record that said defendant couldn't read.
No. There was no indication that he couldn't
read.
We're
assuming when he signed it that he had read the plea form.
Yes, he signed it you sign a document, you're approving it. There are statements in the document that indicate you have reviewed it and that you understand certain things.
Just one last question. If we look at prejudice afforded to this defendant, do we have to look and see whether the defendant would not have pled had he known what the state's burden is? Is that what we have to take into consideration?
Yes, I think the issue is whether or not, had he been given the oral advisement, whether that somehow
would
have made
a
difference.
About this one statement, that the state has the burden of proving your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And it has to be shown, if we look at prejudice, that would have tipped the scales and he would have gone to trial or not pled. Is that?
Yeah, the standard in Stewart and Nero talk about whether he would have pled otherwise or pled differently. And so I think that's the standard for prejudice. And I think under harmless error and plain error, there's no reversal either. I see my initial time has expired. I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Taylor. Mr. Keeling.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The trial court's mistake is cognizable as plain error because it affects a substantial right. Under Boykin, the defendant has the trial court has to ensure that the defendant is aware of the constitutional rights that he or she is giving up in order to make sure that the guilty plea is knowingly and voluntarily entered. The drafters of Criminal Rule 11 had stated that the trial court must personally address the defendant with respect to these issues. It's not enough that they be addressed in a written waiver that the defendant may or may not understand was given to sign in a rushed minute. The trial court has to personally address the defendant and advise him of these rights. And the trial court did not do that. It's affects the substantial right because you're talking about constitutional rights and those are always deemed substantial. So the test then becomes, how does that shift the burden here? It's clearly plain error. And under the Chapman case in California, when you have an error of a constitutional magnitude, in order to show it's harmless, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict. In this case, we don't have a verdict. That's usually the object you look at, so it makes the state's job a little bit harder. You get into things that you talk about in structural error. You deal in structural error because you're talking about consequences of structural error, usually and necessarily unquantifiable. And it's really hard for the state in this situation to show that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because you cannot tell what the defendant would or would not have done had he been properly advised of his rights. And it's important. The drafters of the rule have stated you have to make these assertions and tell the defendant what rights he's given up, and it's easy to do.
Mr. Keeling, are you taking the position that 11C2C has five constitutional rights instead of the three that have been recognized and that we've recognized in various cases? I mean, it talks about the right to jury trial, confront witnesses, compulsory process, and all those three have been recognized in case after case as the constitutional rights. You would have us add the proving guilt beyond reasonable doubt and compelling testimony against oneself as additional constitutional rights?
I don't know that I would have you add them as they are already in the rule and the judges.
But the rule is the rule, and we're talking about an addition.
But as far as determining whether or not I mean, that gets into the test of strict or substantial compliance, and the courts have said, well, we're going to have a strict test with respect to the constitutional rights. And these are constitutional rights. It's like the court, the one appellate court said, is kind of a, doesn't make a lot of sense to, I mean, all five are recognized as constitutional rights. It doesn't make sense to have three of them or four of them require strict compliance and the other require.
But this is important because so far we have not added those two as constitutional rights. And as you say, it's strict compliance with constitutional, and there are other cases that say substantial compliance if it's not constitutional.
And part of that is because the way the case law developed, when Boykin was decided, it was not, it had never been determined that the federal right to have guilt proved beyond a reasonable doubt was also had to apply to the state criminal trials through the due process clause. And it was determined a year later that this was in fact the case. So when Boykin was decided, that wasn't necessarily a situation that had been determined by the United States Supreme Court or was in fact in practice everywhere. So this was a constitutional right that was determined to apply to the states through the due process provision in a case in Ray Winship. So now it is a constitutional right, and it's on par and it's of equal dignity with all the other rights as far as determining whether a plea is knowingly or voluntarily made, and that's what the rule says. The rule, and they are rules of criminal procedure, not suggestions. Now, when we get into this, and this is interesting because no matter how you look at this, as far as what kind of error it is, the defendant should prevail in this case. If it's a constitutional right and strict compliance is required, well, the defendant wins. If it's a substantial compliance test, the defendant also wins because there was no substantial compliance here. First of all, the rule says the court has to personally address the defendant, and that was not done. And the rule says, and it's a simple rule, all this trial court has to do is tell the defendant, do you understand that the state is required to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt at a trial? And if the defendant responds affirmatively, the court then says, are you voluntarily waiving this right? This is what this court suggested in Ballard. You just list those rights, pause, and ask if they understand, and then ask if they understand their guilty plea is waiving this right. It's not difficult. So he was not personally addressed by the judge, and the judge did not put this on the record. What you have, the language in Boykin, it says, a court must establish on the record that a guilty plea was knowingly and voluntarily entered and that the accused understood the important rights that he was waiving by entering the plea. The court further states that the utmost solicitude, this has to be done with the utmost solicitude of which courts are capable. And in this case, it just, courts are capable of asking that simple question, and the court didn't do it.
Mr. Keeling, when we look at the transcript of this, the colloquy, I'm assuming, will be in the record, or at least what the court said at the time of the taking of the plea. Are you saying that the court did not engage in a dialogue with the defendant at all?
No, the court did not address with the defendant anything regarding his understanding that the state was required to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
But there was a dialogue with the with
there was a dialogue that. And the court addressed other rights but not this right.
Isn't
substantial compliance with you, I'm sorry, Jim.
Is your argument the rule is the rule is very specific that the trial judge doesn't just ask if he read this agreement. The trial judge is instructed, these are our rules, the criminal rules, to inform the defendant and then determine whether the defendant understands then these five categories. And before that, and the trial judge shall not accept a plea of guilty or no contest without first addressing the defendant personally and doing all the following. And then, so we seem to have said in our rule when it was adopted that it's important, for whatever reason, it's important for the trial judge to not just ask, have you read, is this your agreement, have you read it, but to actually address the defendant so that the trial court can be certain that the defendant understands what it is he or she is waiving when they when they plead. Isn't that the purpose of the rule? Seems to me it is.
I would suggest that it is, and I think that this is what this court is going to determine. What kind of justice system does it want to preside over in the state of Ohio? There's a rule. It's easily followed. Do you want to give doctrines like substantial compliance when, to me, this doesn't seem like a rule that substantial compliance should even apply. I mean, if you're just coming up with logic, substantial compliance might comply with a rule that's difficult to interpret, difficult to apply. But some rules are simple. If you have a hospital, they have a rules that you count the surgical instruments used before a surgery and you count them again afterwards to make sure you don't leave any inside the body when you sew it up. That's a rule you have strict compliance with. Why not? Substantial compliance really isn't going to do anything in that case.
Counsel, when you say it's not in the record, he did sign a plea entry. Yes.
The way it works in Franklin County is there's a plea form. The prosecutor presents it. It's kind of border plate language. It has a lot of things in there. In this case,
it has this in it.
Yes. And in this, it also had things in there about sentencing for repeat violent offender,
so
which didn't apply.
That is in the record, is it not?
He signed a guilty plea form that in there had language that the state had the burden to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay. But that, I'm asking you the technical question because you said it wasn't in the record. It is in the record, it just wasn't in the...
The judge personally addressing the defendant was not in the record.
But the record does include the plea agreement.
The file is in the file.
So what we would regard as the record. Now, I want to take you on that technical point to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Was a written plea waiver that contained the matters, the constitutionally protected matters present in those cases? Was the deficiency that there was not the oral exchange between the defendant and the judge, or were they not present at
Bond
all in
those case?
Cases? What? In the Boykin case. And
the Boykin case. I don't know the Boykin. Boykin indicates that in order for a plea to be knowingly and voluntarily entered, it has to be apparent on the record that the defendant understands certain constitutional rights that he's giving up. Now, I'm not going to state that the only way that admonition can be complied with is by the judge doing that. The judge may have a bad day and ask the bailiff to, you know, can you read this, address this, and I'll adopt it by reference. You know, a sore throat or something. But the record has to show that the defendant understood and knowingly and voluntarily waived these rights, and that guilty plea form is not enough to do that. It's part of the totality of the situation, but...
Don't we have some cases that is... said you can't cure it just with the written plea?
Well, you can't. That to the extent that that's sufficient to show that the defendant knowingly and voluntarily waived this right, it's not enough because just the way we know how things work in the real world and with the people that come through the court system. I mean, if you would have asked the judge later, did you advise this defendant of all his constitutional rights, he would have said yes, but he would have been mistaken.
Counsel, how, if, just say that we did decide it was substantial compliance, what the judge did, how would you show prejudice to your client?
I think the burden here is the state has to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless. I don't think at this point in time.
I'm just wondering, what did this gentleman plead to the indictment?
No.
So we got a plea bargain?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that indicia of non-prejudicial occurrence?
I don't think so. I think plea bargaining is oftentimes very coercive in nature and often has a substantial influence on people pleading guilty to things they believe they may not be guilty of. In this case, the underlying facts were the discharge of some firearms, a firearm, and the issue would have been at trial the mens rea, the mental intent of the defendant, whether he knowingly attempted to inflict physical harm with a firearm or serious physical harm on his wife, and she wasn't shot. There were shots in a wall and other shots fired.
Didn't he shoot at her as she's running away after the gun jammed?
That wouldn't have been the defense at trial would have been he was just upset because of his concerns with respect to her fidelity.
Well, good luck with that.
And no. The wife, I think, would testify that she didn't think he was trying to shoot her, that he was just trying to scare her. But you have a discharge of a gun. He's facing onerous time, 21 years. You're going to risk going to trial. You're going to take this and all these pressures. They all.
He got a good deal, really, didn't he?
No. He could have. I mean, it could have been 6 months on an aggravated menacing or whatever. But
and so you're telling the court that with all of this as a background, if the judge had said, oh, yeah, and by the way, the burden of proof is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you were guilty, that would have changed everything?
I don't know.
Not entered to the plea?
I don't know. But see, that's the burden the state has, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wouldn't have. And it's almost impossible to do because this is not a case that went to verdict. This is not a case where you can look at the error and look at all the other evidence presented and determine, well, the evidence was so overwhelming that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. We can't do that because, you know, there's all sorts of things. I've stood beside defendants who changed their mind over various objects at the last minute with respect to plea agreements.
So if we agree with you, we would vacate this conviction, remand it to the court, and start all over again.
Oh, just affirm if you affirm the decision, he goes back to square one and he's facing these charges, which
and all
he's
the
willing
time
to do.
And maybe not the same plea bargain.
Exactly. There's no obligation to give any plea bargain. I mean, that's the
so
risk.
By winning, your client could end up serving more, facing a more severe penalty than he has at the moment.
Without a question. And that's something I talked at length with him about. And he still wants to do and felt that he did not knowingly and voluntarily enter his plea. And that's what this court's position is. It's to ensure that justice is done and that people don't plead guilty to something they may not think they're guilty of.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Thank you. That would conclude my argument if there are no further questions.
Healy. Mr. Taylor, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds. I'm going to use most of it with a question of you. What concerns me about this case is not that the defendant here may not be guilty. We've seen, as you know, you follow our cases and you argue some of them, as you know, we've seen a number of cases, not a lot, but enough cases in which we're challenged to decide whether to hold trial judges to the rules or the statute, to hold them strictly to a rule or a statute. And one argument is, well, they came close or substantial compliance, and so unless the defendant can show prejudice, we let that error by the trial judge go. The other view is that it's the criminal justice system, and we want to be certain that when someone is convicted or pleads or whatever, that they do so by the rules. And that's the divide. We have it on this court, and we have it obviously with counsel, that someone has to say, either we're gonna go by the rules, this is very simple. I mean, the trial judge here didn't have a colloquy with doing what the rule says. And so we have the decision of, well, but he came close because the trial judge came close because there's a written agreement, and we can say, well, the defendant probably knew what his rights were and what he was giving up. But The problem with that view is that if we adopt that view consistently in cases, it seems to me that what happens, human nature, trial judges are busy, and so they just begin to skip things. Just, well, we don't have to do that because the Supreme Court says substantial compliance. I got close. I didn't get the mark, but I got close, and so that's good enough. I guess the view to which I usually ascribe is that is not good enough is not good enough. That we need to be saying firmly to trial judges that if it's clear what you're to do, then you have to do it. And if you don't, it's strict compliance. I think substantial compliance is a situation in which the trial judge attempts to follow the rule, but uses words that a defense counsel may say, well, I don't think the defendant could understand that, and we get to those arguments. To me, that's the substantial, I'm a little different than others, but to me, that's where substantial compliance is should be applied, where the trial judge attempted to do it, but didn't get it quite right or muddled the words or whatever, haste and so forth, we know. Now, this is not a lecture to you, but you've been around a long time and you've argued a lot of these cases. What's your view of that?
Well, the rule is clear that, and I say the rule, not the rule is clear that there has to be an oral advisement on this, and so there is error. But Criminal Rule 52, in my view, is also clear that judgments will not be reversed when the error is harmless or when, in the absence of an objection, there is no plain error. And so 52 has to be applied just as rigorously as Criminal Rule 11. And our contention is that you can recognize the error, that will have some educational value for the bench and bar, but in the end, you also have to obey Criminal Rule 52. And so I put something in my brief about we don't just reverse judgments just to teach lessons to the lower courts. You can chastise them all you want in the opinion and say, you know, this should be done. And I've seen a number of cases, literal compliance is what we want. But in the end, this court has often returned to the fact that we think the defendant knew this right and knew of this right. And so in the end, there's no reversal. And I think under Criminal Rule 52, that's this court's obligation, is to not reverse.
The difficulty with showing prejudice in a case where there's a plea, Mr. Keeling, record a trial, then it's perhaps more easy to determine whether a defendant was prejudiced, or party was prejudiced by an error. But whether it's a plea, how do we determine that? How does the system determine whether you bring the defendant back in and ask him would his plea have been different, or how do we do that?
Well, you search the record to see if he had the information through other means. In the Vaughn case, for example, the defendant had been, and that was the U.S. Supreme Court, and there's a requirement under their Criminal Rule 11 that the defendant be advised of the right to counsel at a trial. And the defendant in that case had been advised four times before in an earlier hearing that he had a right to counsel. And so the failure of the trial court to mention that at the plea hearing, the U.S. Supreme Court said, was not plain error, and would be harmless error. And I think you look for other places in the record where it shows that the defendant was in fact aware of the right. The prosecutor may have mentioned it. The defense attorney may have mentioned it. The colloquy between the defendant and between the defense counsel and the court may have mentioned it in the defendant's presence. You look for things like that to see if the defendant was aware of it. Now, between the three standards that I think should potentially apply here, substantial compliance puts the burden on the defendant to demonstrate prejudice. Harmless error puts the burden on the state to show that it was harmless. Plain error puts the burden on the defendant to show that it's plain error warranting reversal. I think we went under all those standards, and because of the fact that he approved the entry of guilty plea that covered this right, he indicated to the court, in response to the court's questioning, that he had that he and his attorney had reviewed his constitutional rights, and so.
The question is, how does a defendant show prejudice? how does the defendant show, if I had known this information, I would not have entered the plea? That's the question. Is it an insurmountable burden for a defendant to have to come forward with that type of evidence?
Well, if the record contains no other indication that that he was aware of the right, the defendant might be able to show that, look, there was no other indication, and there may, perhaps there's an indication that he had a potential defense. So he might be able to show prejudice that way. If harmless error analysis applies, it's our burden to show that it's harmless. And we can point to these other things in the record to show that it would have made zero difference to the defendant. In conclusion, I would just ask that the court reverse the 10th District and remand to that court to deal with the other issue that regarding understanding nature of the charge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.